Welcome to Making Docs. I'm Caroline, a freelance documentary director.
And I'm Paul, an aspiring documentary film producer. Follow us on this journey where we speak to industry professionals to get practical advice on the filmmaking process. In this episode, we're back with the story consultant Nick Guttridge to learn more about the art of storytelling by deconstructing the successful Netflix original documentary feature film, Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened. Welcome back to the show, Nick.
Thank you very much, Paul.
And we're back in, it's not your attic, it's your master bedroom.
It is a bedroom.
And this time, Nick has chosen to wear clothes.
I have, but you two, I mean,
thank
for goodness
God.
Sake, what's going on with you guys today? I mean,
No. I can confirm we were both wearing clothes.
Yeah, it's what you've chosen. You swapped clothes today.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show again, Nick.
Pleasure.
We wanted to catch up with you again because there's so much we can cover about storytelling. I felt that we scratched the surface the first time that we spoke to you. But when we spoke off camera, we talked about the fact that there isn't really much out there in terms of the podcast world where anyone's really deconstructing documentary films.
Right.
In a way where we can kind of investigate and look at the story side of it and how that's developed and manipulated and used within documentary film. So we decided to come back to the story consultant, Nick, you,
woo,
and deconstruct a film. So we chose the film
Fire, The Greatest Party That Never Happened, which is a very intriguing title. It's a documentary directed by Chris Smith, and not to be confused with another film about the Fire Festival. So
right.
This Fire Festival got a few documentaries out
Fire
there.
Fire Fraud.
Fire Fraud, exactly. So the one that we're going to analyze today is the one on Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a Netflix original. So get onto Netflix and watch it if you haven't already. And it's a film about the Fire Festival, which was billed as a luxury music experience on a posh private island, but it failed spectacularly in the hands of cocky entrepreneur Billy McFarland.
Billy McFarland. Dun, maniacal laugh.
And as Caroline said, directed by Chris Smith, who also directed Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond in 2017, which is on Netflix. And that's another great film. And he recently did The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann.
Also on Netflix.
Also on Netflix.
Obviously something going on
Netflix
there.
Director.
Okay, Nick. So shall we start this by giving the listeners a kind of a breakdown of the Fire story?
Okay. It's essentially a disaster movie where our hero or anti-hero is a chap called Billy McFarland. Billy McFarland was, by his accounts, a fairly successful entrepreneur working out of New York. And he had this idea for a new app that was going to allow ordinary people to book famous music acts to appear at their weddings, christenings, and so forth, which he was going to launch in association with Ja Rule. And as part of the launch strategy, the concept for promotion was to run the mother of all festivals called Fire Festival, in which you would be buying a luxury lifestyle for yourself for a couple of days, enjoying the company of beautiful influencer-type models in a stunning Bahamian location, listening to your favourite acts, eating the finest food and staying in marvellous villas.
Living your best life.
Living your best life, Paul. I'm quite happy here in my little attic room.
Pablo Escobar's Island.
Oh, Pablo Escobar, formerly owned by Pablo Escobar.
They weren't allowed to say, which they did immediately in the promotion video.
So we're then on a journey to watch this festival being built, supposedly. Unfortunately, of course, it never actually gets built because it's fatally flawed in a number of ways. I think we're told in the film that to have any chance of putting something like this together, you'd need at least a year's lead time. I think the guys here had like 6 weeks to throw it all together. They were dealing with a situation where the island they were going to be using, they ultimately weren't allowed to use. They had inadequate accommodation. They weren't able to sustain the contract with caterers. The event was washed out the night before it was due to take place. We're basically on this kind of sort of emotional roller coaster ride with the organisers who were attempting behind the scenes to get all this sorted. All the time they're telling us, we knew it wasn't going to work. Billy was just digging in saying it's definitely going to work. We sort of believe Billy because he's an amazing guy. He knows how to make these things happen. But of course, ultimately, it doesn't work. And we also then see the absolute failure and the fallout of it from the point of view of guests who have paid up to, I think, $12,000 a pop to come over and stay in supposedly luxury accommodation, which ends up being hurricane tents that have been washed out by the storm the night before, who were left to eat soggy cheese sandwiches rather than gourmet meals, and for who all the acts have pulled out already, so there's literally nothing to see here. And they're stranded, basically, in some vision of hell, not too happy, having lost a lot of money along the way. That's the disaster that we're here to see. We're seeing it from the point of view, if you like, of the henchman who helped Billy to try and build this dream.
What kind of documentary film is Fire? Billy's not talking on camera. We don't necessarily hear from him. Yeah. So what kind of film is it?
So when I approach things as a filmmaker, I'm thinking about what problems do I have to overcome here? You know, what's going to make this a good film? I think when you hear about the Fire Festival story, as a storyteller, there's no doubt this is a great story, right? You know, before you begin, there's something here that's going to be interesting. This would have dominated headlines in America, if not around the world. It passed me by, but that's because, you know, I'm an old man and have no aspiration to go and hang out with supermodels on beaches. Honest.
I do.
But yeah. But where do you start? I suppose the two challenges that you face with this subject, firstly, are what are you going to see? Because it's all happened already, so you've got a big issue there to overcome. If you're going to make this an engaging film, on some level, you've got to think about, you know, how am I going to make that work visually for our audience? And secondly, who's going to tell me that story? So the questions I ask myself when I get to the end of this sort of film and I think, oh, this has worked. You know, I like this film. I don't think it's perfect. We can talk about things that, you know, I think maybe aren't quite successful for me. But I like the film. It's a strong piece of work. Why does it work? Well, it works because on the first level, he managed to get hold of some fascinating first-person archive. Without that, you haven't got this film. So Billy McFarland, as you say, Paul, he's the instigator of this piece. He, if you like, is the hero or anti-hero in this story. And he is a presence in the film because he's a presence in this archive that was taken throughout the process, almost megalomaniacally and maniacally filming everything that moved around him. So having secured access to that, you have some rich content that we can engage in as viewers and go on a journey with them.
But what type of documentary film is it? Is there like a category for this?
I would call it a historical ensemble piece. See, it's a retrospective telling, and it's made up of an ensemble cast. It's not a first-person character film. It's not an unfolding narrative. It's living in the past, and it's being told by an ensemble. You know, I'd be struggling to categorize it more
focused
than that.
More on the theme in the end. Like, it doesn't focus... I mean, it focuses on a lot of characters, but it's not really in-depth on the characters. Like, we find out a few things about them, but it's not a story about the... For example, employees of this Fire Media.
Correct.
It's just about Fire Festival.
Correct. And I guess I don't want to throw in criticism too soon because it works, you know, and he's built a cast that tells that story very well. You know, we're walked through step by step what happened. And to a certain extent, we are there with the people who were on the front line with him. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, we get insights into their experiences. But what we are largely looking at is a factual telling of the story through these people's eyes, and it's very successful in that. My heart and instincts as a filmmaker are that character is the way to create the most compelling of films. So you can make a brilliant film out of anything, but I think the most compelling films for me, and I think for a lot of people, are when you really get into the heart of a human story. And I'm not sure you do get there with this film, which is why, although I think it's very successful as a story, as a rich story, I'm not sure that I'm as compelled by the experiences I'm being given as I would be if I was really getting to know the characters. Now, there are some characters within the film who offer us some gold, you know, and there are moments there where you are getting real insights into their stories, and I would love to have drawn that out more. And an example that jumps out is one of the event organisers called Andy, who'd known Billy for years, was a big supporter of his, actually went, by his own account, was one of the voices who was trying to tell everybody, no, trust this guy, he knows what he's doing, he knows what he's doing. And poor Andy, at some point, found himself at a customs office in Miami or something, considering offering sexual services to a customs officer to get some water supplies released. I mean, that is a powerful first-person story. But we don't know Andy well enough as a character within the film for that to resonate beyond just, oh my God, what an extraordinary thing to happen to you. Mm. And there's a few moments like that where there's a woman who ran the restaurant in the island, exactly. You know, and she breaks down in tears at the end because actually she had to stump up lots of her own savings to pay for workers to get paid when this whole thing went belly up and no one had any money. And that's a very raw moment, and it's very well handled in the edit because we're allowing her to sit there and let pauses open up and her emotion comes through. Mm-hmm. But we've only seen her once or twice before in the film, so although it's a strong human moment, we're not, I believe, getting as much out of that as an audience as we might do if we'd been on the ride more with her throughout the film. But none of that is to say it's unsuccessful. It's just that's something I would have looked at perhaps a bit differently with my more character-focused telling of the story.
In our last episode, we talked with you about opening with impact.
Right.
How would you describe the opening here?
So visually, very striking. They open with images from a promo video, mm-hmm. which was designed to sell the event to its wannabe audience of young millennials with lots of disposable income who want to go and party with supermodels and live the ideal lifestyle. So it's shots of clear blue waters.
Colour of the water.
Yeah, beautiful.
Just amazing.
More documentaries should start with supermodels.
Oh, God.
Yeah, absolutely. We should work that in future podcasts, Paul. We'll see how films could have been improved.
All my future films are going to start with supermodels. Yeah, they're going to start with supermodels.
So visually, I think it's starting to hook us in. You know, we have to assume that the audience also, wants to watch this film because they want to enjoy the atmosphere of what was on offer within this festival as well. So we're being sold up front. So visually, I think it's very good. In terms of what we're hearing, I guess I'd go back to the point I just made about character, really. We're given a sense of what the story is. You know, we need that. This was a festival. It was pitched at millennials. It's going to be the party to change the world, whatever it might be. But it all went wrong. And now...
Backstory.
And now man might go to prison for it. You know, so that's interesting. That's great. And that's very well done. But that's sort of where it ends. And I think there's one, if memory serves me right, there's one sort of personal thought in there from someone, which is one of the contributors postulating that, they hope Billy doesn't go to prison for what he's done. And that is someone making a personal thought, but it's a personal thought about someone else. So we're not, again, it's not something that necessarily is able to engage us in a sort of primal way where we're looking into the whites of someone's eyes and hearing them say, and that was when I found myself rinsing mouthwash into my mouth so that I could prepare myself for delivering a sexual service to this man in customs. Oh, okay. Yeah. That sort of thing is, to me, much more of a hook that makes me want to kind of pay attention and see, what's this guy's story? You know, I'm interested in who's this guy sitting here and what's he got to offer me here? Mm-hmm. But the beginning does what it needs to do, and it does it with style. Mm-hmm. For me, the open with impact sort of mantra that I have, I think it could have gone one or two notches a bit tighter to crank it up a bit more. Mm-hmm. But it works. You know, I'm definitely interested in this story. Mm-hmm. And what you must do with this film from the outset is let people know you've got an extraordinary story coming up, because you really do have an extraordinary story coming up. So if you need to make sure you're conveying that. And I think it does do that successfully.
But also, you've got to get to know the characters. And I think they're quite successful in doing that in the opening as well, because they're on the island. You get to see what Billy's like, what Ja Rule is like, who are two of the main protagonists. You don't get to know them in depthly, but you get a sense of their character.
Yeah. But I think that's an interesting observation, because I think you're right in saying that you actually quite cleverly do get to know Billy. And throughout the film, you get quite a good impression or a version of Billy through the film. But I would say he's possibly the person that you get to know best, even though he's not in the film. And I think that's an interesting importance, because he is the protagonist here. But this is a henchman story. You know, the people that we're sitting and we're watching here are the henchmen to this story. And they have a story to tell, and they are telling their story. But I would like to have known, if we're in this world, let's find out a bit more about these guys and what it felt like to be them. I don't know, because there's so many people in the film, I don't know that we have enough time to properly get to know them. And so we're sort of constantly deflecting back into Billy, which is fine. You know, it works.
I suppose it starts at a bit of a peak, because they reach the heights of being on the Barbados island, living their best life with the supermodels. Mm-hmm. Where do you go from there?
Right.
And it's almost as though it's teeing up the film to only go one way after that.
I think, yes, you're right. And I think the film is kind of relentlessly heading for disaster all the way through, and compellingly so. You know, it's one thing after another, from the marketing guys not really having a handle on you know, what's going on and being a bit overwhelmed, to a pilot that he met ending up running logistics for a while, to picking a location with no running water and plumbing and whatever. You know, everything is stacked up for failure. So you feel that you're kind of relentlessly heading in that direction, and at some point we're going to reach there, and oh my God, you know. So yes, it does carry you on that journey quite successfully.
You talk a bit on the last podcast, Nick, about story arcs, and I've been in a workshop with you where you've talked about it being like a, really what you're aiming for is like a roller coaster where it goes up and down a lot. What I found with this film is that
it's... You painted something as well.
Is that it? Yeah, I've got a little drawing on my pad. I made a few notes for this one. But what I found is that it starts at that peak where they're living their best life, and it continues to go down, and it just gathers pace. And if I was to compare it to a roller coaster, I'd compare it to maybe Oblivion at Alton Towers. I don't know if you've been on that one, where very small journey to get to the peak, but then it's just a vertical down, right, and that's all the ride is. There isn't many kind of ups and downs in the ride.
Yeah.
It's just...
How did you find that as a viewer watching it? How did that work for you?
I enjoyed it. Like you said, I didn't feel as though I got to know Billy that well, but you kind of... Billy portrays this kind of... He's just a really negative kind of character, but I don't know. I really enjoyed that ride. I like the Oblivion as a ride as well. So I really appreciated the film, and yeah, it made me feel, I don't know. I just enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I think I was expecting it up at some point.
Right.
I think towards the end, like, Billy doesn't go to prison, and he starts a new business, and he lives his best life, and he ends up marrying a supermodel. Yeah. I suppose I'm conditioned to expect that up at some point.
It's quite nice. Quite nice textually, I think, the ending, actually. There is no justice, you know, here. That's unexpected, isn't it? As you say, so it's actually, as a viewer, I think, that's a surprising ending, which is, you know, I think, textually interesting.
But the filmmaker, I think, still tries to bring it up at the end, in that he makes a bit of a point through the interviews that if there's one thing in America that Americans like, it's people who are good at being able to part consumers with their cash.
Yeah.
And so people like Billy ultimately should bounce back, especially in America. But that's a 30-second, one-minute part of the ending. Right. Whereas the rest of the film is just a spiral downwards.
Yeah. So for me, with my sort of story consultant sort of, you know, head on and storytelling head on, you know, I guess I have a bit of an issue with that lack of texture as well. You know, I think, I don't know Roller Coaster, I don't know Oblivion literally, but for me, I think that the sense of anticipation of what's to come is as powerful in some ways as then the actual, you know, shock of the fall and so forth. And as you say, we're kind of constantly on this downward slope from the start. I think there would have been a way. You could have built a kind of crescendo that felt everything was great, and end act one, if you like, with that, and then rewind and deconstruct what was really going on and the reasons, therefore, why it was always undermined and going to fail. But we're not given that opportunity. We get to know the people who were the guests and wanted to come and enjoy this party. What they were seeing was this dream. They sold the dream very successfully to them, as a result of which the whole thing sold out very quickly, we're told. Mm-hmm. That feels like a success story, and we could have seen it in a more superficial way initially, mm-hmm. before deconstructing why it went wrong. But instead, as we're being told they hired the best in the business, we're also being told, but there was a problem. And so it's always this kind of sense that it's disaster going to happen. Things are going wrong all the time. And that's fine, it works. But might there be another way through it where you go, okay, it's all good, success, talent, gloss, glory, ticket sales, boom, it's going to be amazing. You know, Jarrell saying, we want people to come and enjoy the biggest party the world's ever seen. Yeah. Boom, yeah, I'm on board. How did this go wrong? Now let's find out how it went wrong, rather than being drip, drip, drip from the start.
I wonder why they chose to do that, do you think?
It's just a very linear narrative that you know, we're with the contributors who were there from the inside, and they're telling us their version of events from the inside. Now, there is a bit, if one goes to why that happened, there is a sort of backstory to the film that's probably worth discussing, which is that this film was co-produced by a lot of people who were in the film.
So Jerry
Media, who were the marketing people, I think, the promo team, are all have a stake in this film. And actually, I think one of the successes from the director's point of view is that, as you say, you wouldn't necessarily know that to watch the film. They definitely don't get a free pass. through this. You know, they are put on the line, they are implicated in having done some fairly dodgy things or having been part of this problem, but they're not hung out to dry. It's all focused
on
Billy.
Not to sugarcoat Billy. What happened. Yeah.
They're kind of painted as foot soldiers under Billy's command, so they're kind of following orders and they're being given a carrot. Like, most of them aren't going to be paid until the festival's happened.
Yeah.
So they justify kind of misleading and going along with it because of that. So they don't get completely away from it, but I suppose they do have the opportunity to have their say.
Absolutely.
As well, and to make sure that they do look good out this.
I mean, yes, they're definitely the ones who are implicated as being the problem here. You know, we hear a couple of times the sense that people in New York didn't know anything about what was going on the front line. You know, we the first we knew was when we flew over there and so forth. Well, was that really, you know, we don't know, was that the truth? But when you start viewing it from the prism that these people are in some way associates with the filmmaking process, then that might change the way you view it. But as a piece of filmmaking, I think it still stands up. It's an interesting story. I don't think anyone's denying that Billy was the main problem here. You know, the other film, Fire Fraud, does take a slightly more damning view of the people from Jerry Media and so forth as well, who seem to know more than this film would suggest they are. So the two films together kind of maybe give you a more complete picture of the whole. But I think as a bit of filmmaking, this one that we're talking about now is more successful.
Mm-hmm. Could one of the reasons for a more linear story arc that they choose also be that it is something that already happened? Because they're kind of like portraying something that you can read about in all media, because it was something that happened in this big influencer area we talked about. So it's out there.
Yeah. And there's no need to mess with the structure. You know, we want to build relentlessly towards this car crash and so forth. So it works. I think I have a problem with, but whenever a film is very linear, and whenever I'm presented with a film that feels very linear, I just find myself thinking, is this the best way to do it? Is there something more clever or tricksy we can do here? And the answer sometimes is no. You know what? This works absolutely fine. I've no problem with this. But it's worth having that conversation, I think, because, like you identified, Paul, and for many filmmakers, it's about the peaks and troughs that you can bring into things. And actually, if you are feeling like you're relentlessly on a down all the way through, I mean, that's incredibly compelling because the story's so rich and textured. And what else can go wrong? And how can they not have thought of this? And why are they still trying to save this? You know, it's really powerful.
It's just a different kind of ride.
But, yeah, it's a different kind of ride. Yeah.
It's just as good, you know.
We'll never know.
There are so many things that are unfolding in the story, like incredible things. And you just go, yeah, okay.
Right.
Well, they had a storm. He could have cancelled the festival, which is what the whole team was saying, but he didn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, cool. He let all the influencing people go to the island. Like, okay, you know, like you get to the point where you just accept as an audience because there's so many terrible things happening.
And that's kind of fun. What else is going to go wrong? Yeah. It keeps happening.
It's a really important point to talk about because, again, a successful film has to grab the audience in some way. It has to be compelling. Now, I've said, for me, one of the most powerful ways you can do that is through good first-person testimony where you're hearing emotional experiences being told to you and on a human level through our, if we're not psychopaths, through our empathy with, you know, humanity and so on, we can tap into what it feels like to be worried, scared, joyful, excited, you know, these things. So whatever these emotions people are going through, we can relate to that. We get some of that in this, but we don't get as much as I would suggest I would like to have had. But that's fine. That's not a criticism. That was a choice that they made to tell the story in that way, to make it a big ensemble piece, and you know, it does it successfully. So why then, as a viewer, am I interested? What am I feeling that makes that hook still work for me? And I think it is these things. Like, we understand what it feels like to be looking at someone who has an ego that we want it to pop in a way. You know, can he get away with this or no? You know, why is he being so stubborn here? Why is he being so blind? These are things that we can get angry about and make us feel something, because we're aware of those frustrations of dealing with people like that in our own lives, for example, of building this sense of this could have been avoided, or why aren't you doing the right thing here? You know, this is going to end in disaster. There's no way out of this hole. You're digging a hole for these people. We're rooting for these people to kind of for it all to work out well on some level, but we know it's not going to. And this kind of inner turbulence that as a viewer you get, I think, is what makes it successful as a viewing experience. I would say, though, I think for all the fact that you enjoy Oblivion as much as the other roller coasters, I think for me, and this is just my take on it, I quite like being surprised as a viewer and having sort of big rug pulls, you know, along the way.
You like twists and turns.
I like twists and turns. And I think there's something for me about the idea of knowing something is coming up. We know from the outset it's not going to end well, but why is that? Is could be a question that you hold back. And so if you build a kind of success story to start with, it all looks great. And then you sort of ask yourself, how does this go wrong? What's going on? Then when they go, let's rewind and tell us what's really going happening. I think there's something that you could add to the sort of texture of the story that might, for me, have made something a bit more satisfying. Like, oh, great, now we're going to get into it, rather than always being drip-fed this stuff along the way, which again, I say works, but I might have chosen a slightly different path, or at least to have explored that path.
Stories are normally told in three acts, is that right?
They don't have to be. I mean, I think it's a style of storytelling that is often very successful.
Do you see that with this film?
Yeah, and there's three acts in it, and often the breakdown of the acts is act two is massive. It's often the way this plays out. So act one, in this case, would be the backstory building up to the launch of the app. We're going to have Run Fire Festival. The promo's ready. Let's go.
Which is quite short. It's about 20
minutes.
Which
is quite short. Yeah, yeah. I guess it'd be probably about 20 minutes. Yeah, and I guess in my reworking of that, it would be a kind of positive news story up to the end of act one. But they've taken up the point where we're good to go now. Let's go live. Let's build this thing, yeah. You know? And then act two is, let's build this thing. Oh my God, it's disastrous. It's going to happen. It's happening. What the hell are we going to do about it? You know, and unravel. And then act three becomes the final, the sort of turning point at the end. What's happened since Fire with that we see Billy and his kind of new life trying to, you know, restart a new business.
It's also quite short. It's like 10 minutes. Short. So in between there, we have about an hour and 20 minutes, yeah, of just down.
Yeah.
Which is great fun for me.
Down, but again, structurally, what they've done and quite by necessity is the event itself. I don't know where in the timeline it falls, but I would imagine that the event itself is roughly the midpoint of that.
Yes.
Act two.
I believe it is. When the guy offers to do the sexual act,
right,
to help the festival, that comes after 50 minutes.
Yeah.
When the attendees to the festival see the camp for the first time, that for me is the big reveal,
right,
for them, and you're,
right,
on a journey with them, and that's after 60 minutes,
right,
of the film.
Yeah.
But it just continues to keep going,
yeah,
down
it does,
after that.
But from a different,
well,
perspective,
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So and again, that's really well handled. We only meet our first guest around the midway point in the film, I think, where they start to appear. So suddenly you've got a different perspective on things, which just helps to mix up a little bit and give you a different take on things. So, yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise to me that what we would describe as Act 2 is so huge, because the journey, which is what Act 2 kind of is what you want to get into. You know, if you're looking at a film like Lord of the Rings or whatever, you know, the big quest is a chunky piece of work. It's what is it that, what are the stages within that journey that keep you interested. What this film does successfully throughout that part is give you a series of new chapters, you know, along the way. And often it's just a kind of good storytelling practice. He'll use a very powerful line of sync to draw a full stop under one thing or to throw forward to something else. And therefore you turn a slight corner. So I remember an example where the director is asking someone what their take on Billy was. Mm-hmm. And he was like, I wasn't sure if he was a madman or a genius or something. Well, what do you think about him now? He's a liar. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's, mm-hmm, quite a powerful full stop, boom, and that throws into a bit of backstory on Billy to get a bit more sense of who he was and so forth. So it's quite successfully using these punctuation points to just throw us into something new along the way. So although we're still moving in one direction all the time, we're able to turn pages, you know, along the way, which keeps us more engaged.
Last time we talked a little bit about the hero's journey. Maybe you can briefly resume what that is, and also kind of applying that now to a film, as we said, like Fire Festival, that it's more theme focused and has a lot of characters in it, and one main character who isn't actually in the film, like actively in an interview. Where's the hero's journey there?
Okay, so my take on the hero's journey, firstly, hero's journey is a kind of archetype of storytelling which was laid down by an American author in the mid-20th century, and he had basically identified that, I think he would go as far as say all great stories, or even all stories, follow a certain type, and the template for that goes back to sort of Greek mythology and those classic tales of the hero setting out on a quest. So the hero's journey became this device, and it's become part and parcel of storytelling, particularly in drama storytelling. George Lucas famously credited the chap that came up with the theory, Joseph Campbell, with inspiring the narrative arc behind Star Wars. But you'll see it in The Hobbit, you'll see it in Pride and Prejudice, you'll see it in, you know, lots of classic great stories can be broken down in this way. The essence of it, I can't remember all the beats top of my head, but it'll be, there's a call to arms, you know, you've got normal life's happening, there's a call to arms, something's got to change. You might resist that call because you're nervous about whether you're going to be able to pull it off or not. Then something comes along that makes you think, I've got to cross the threshold and get on and do this. Mm-hmm. You encounter a series of trials along the way, culminating in a massive trial, which you overcome. You win some prize as a result of that, and then you head for home full of glory, meeting some other challenge that's going to just make you crystallize your thinking, hopefully conquer your demons, literally and metaphorically, and then you walk home changed, transformed, and the whole your life and the world around you is better because of it. As I say, in drama, you can write these beats and they're very good ways of structuring your story. In factual and documentary, I struggle with this sort of thing because although I think there's no doubt that this sort of story type is powerful, is compelling, it works, you know, damn it, it works. As a filmmaker, as a documentary filmmaker approaching a subject, if you've got fitting a story type in your mind when you're making a film, I think you're tying yourself up in knots where you don't really need to. You know, the story needs to tell itself, it needs to lead you in the direction it's going to take you in, and you don't need to be following a set pattern in order to tell a compelling story. Retrospectively, it's quite possible to look at things and make them fit these story types. Oh, this is doing this job, you know, it's therefore clearly a hero's journey. I'd be very surprised if this film at any point the director thought, I'm making a hero's journey here. He's just making a good film.
Could you translate it in documentary, as you always say, like something needs to be at stake?
So the way I break it down is, yes, something needs to be at stake. I like the three act structures. It's a personal thing. I like viewing things as three acts. I think that's helpful, and that's kind of as simple as a beginning, middle, and an end. But what we really mean is a hook. You know, something to hook us in. Mm-hmm. So in Fire, we've got the initial hook, which is the kind of titles, if you like, is, here's the glossy images, here's a sense of we've got a bit of drama here, something went badly wrong with this mother of all parties, someone's freedom might be at stake, you know, okay, I'm interested by this. Mm-hmm. Now we know that something's going to go wrong, though, I'm invested in it, so how's that going to play out? So we're off, I'm hooked. As we step over the threshold and out onto our adventure, you know, I'm kind of interested by what lies ahead. The journey is that big act two, and then the resolution, if you like, would be, has justice been done, or, you know, what's happened next at the end of it. So the three act structure kind of works, and I think in most films you'll find that in some way, because if most films have a kind of internal start to finish narrative where you're setting something up, here's what happened, and here's the fallout from that. Not all of them, but most of them do, and this one does fit that type. In terms of something being at stake, I think that is a crucial thing to hook an audience in. If something is at stake for someone, if I as an audience can watch this film knowing why I'm on this journey because something matters at the heart of it, then I'm interested. So in this case, it went wrong. How did it go wrong? Who's going to pay the price for that? Is there justice at the end of it? All these things have something at stake for someone, and therefore I've got something to latch myself
for
onto.
Each character, that's the thing. It's not only one character. You kind of get, I mean, we talked about that you don't get an in-depth views into each character, but I mean, the Fire employees, they're, something's at stake for them. They're losing their
all
jobs.
Of them had that. Yeah. As a whole, every single person sitting in talking to us had something at stake.
Had something
there.
At stake.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I kind of think in the end it's nicely put, because all of them have thoughts about what they have done wrong as well.
Yeah.
Like them personally, they see a certain responsibility for everything. Like I think one of the contributors at least says, like, okay, we live in this society where 25 influencers can, like, kind of, they have this great festival or, like, I don't know, put it out into the world, but we have the responsibility. In the end, we did this. We didn't stand up. We didn't say anything. So I think all of these questions in terms of future, I think the film ends with someone of them saying, okay, I wouldn't be surprised if Billy in 10 years has another adventure and, I don't know, commits the same crime in that sense again.
Yeah, and you believe he might, right, as well?
He might,
think he will.
You're completely on his side, and I think that's very powerful, and it's a very internal journey that went on for them as well.
Yeah.
But then again, as you said, emotionally, I'm not that intrigued because I might not have gotten to know them that well.
Yeah. It's just, I would say, what sort of film is this? I mean, it's just a really well-told story. It's a romp, you know, that's what it is. And it's a really well-done romp. You know, you're off on an adventure through an absolute disaster. It's a disaster movie maybe as well. But you're there with the people who were behind the scenes making this thing happen. And that's an interesting perspective on things. Because you would think, as a filmmaker, you would think that the absence of Billy might be a problem for you. You know, you'd be shooting for that, surely. If you want to tell this story, he's the main guy. And again, there are some stories we can talk about with this film, particularly why that didn't happen, which are quite interesting textually to kind of understand what may be going on there. But having accepted that Billy's not going to be part of the film, this is a very, very successful film in making this kind of the associate story work. You know, you are with the people who may be going to give you a more honest take on what happened, because they're the ones behind the scenes, they're not the front man, their egos aren't necessarily the ones on the line here, you know. So yeah, it works very well. Billy, just to fill you in, so again, there's two stories circulating about this. So Billy McFarlane does feature in Fire Fraud, the sort of rival documentary, if you like. And a couple of stories go that he was offered a fee to appear in Fire Fraud, and allegedly quite a large fee, which morally
he needs to make
kind
money
of,
now.
Well, I know, but morally, you know, I kind of have a bit of an
prison,
issue.
Is he?
I have an issue with that, given that he allegedly has cost so many people so much money that he should be rewarded for that by telling his story. But this one story runs that Billy actually approached the makers of this film and said, "Look, I'll do it for you if you can actually do it for less money." I think the story runs, but give me $100,000 and I'll appear on your documentary. And our hero director in this one supposedly said, "Not interested, sorry mate, we're not going to pay you for your trouble because you're the bad guy in this piece and you shouldn't be benefiting from the telling of this story," which is the version we want to believe happened. Yeah. The other story that I've seen told is one where Billy actually was due to be part of this film and had a back-end slice of the production lined up for him, so there would be some sort of financial return, but he never turned up on the day to be interviewed. There's probably five other truths out there as to what really happened. But for whatever reason, he isn't a part of this film. If I can just throw to the other film, you might think that the presence of Billy McFarlane in that film would be, you know, a crowning glory and would make for scintillating viewing. Actually, it doesn't. I felt that the directors of that film were trying very hard to justify the fact they had him and were giving him more screen time than his content delivered. There's lots of use of pauses and silences and so on, which can be very effective, but he gives so little that I don't really find much power in those as well. So actually, this film, Fire, is possibly better not having him in it and just seeing him through the archive, where you get to see him in action and being Billy, you know, where it's very authentic and you get to really, you know, understand the kind of person that he might be, the ego that's driving him, the playboy kind of wannabe, you know, his determination to kind of dig in there at all costs, you know, the stuff that we're being told about by our contributors seems to be evidenced by what we're seeing in the archive, you know. So even though we've got to accept that some of these contributors have a vested interest in the film process and they're part of the production team on some level, it does feel at least like their truth is balanced out what we're seeing, you know, online where it comes to criticizing Billy.
What was the core message of the film for you?
I think for me the theme of the film is that kind of power of influence. It's that, that's what I sort of, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I think on one level Fire was all about tapping into the influencer culture and people wanting, knowing that people would want to buy into that vision. At the same time, it's about the power of influence that Billy had over everyone around him and the way that they were led down a sort of dark alley to the point of destruction as well. And I think, you know, it's reflecting on that concept of how gullible, how hungry we are to be associated with glamour and success and so forth. It's, you know, there's some sort of statement on a slice of our contemporary society there. Yeah, influence. And I don't think that's overt within the film, but I don't think it needs to be. I think it's sort of I think it's nudging you in that direction. I think, you know, a less brave filmmaker might have tried to make more of that and said, so, you know, we're making a film about this, but actually I think that's kind of what is there anyway, and we react to it in that way as well. You know, you either got Schadenfreude for the fact that these people felt, you know, thank God that these idiots with all their money, you know, came unstuck, or you feel sympathy for the fact that people were led down a path they couldn't escape from, or whatever. But it's on some level tapping into that sense that we understand how manipulation can work, and it's quite successful in evoking that.
It's subtle, as you said, like the critical point of view and influencer, but I mean, I talk about the legal consequences this whole Fyre Festival had in the end, mm-hmm. with influencers. They have to hashtag, like, actually that it's make very clear that it's advertising, that they're getting paid for it. It had legal consequences for all these model influencers, I think.
Yeah.
At least they had to pay. I mean, I don't know if they had to in the end, but they got sued.
The Kardashian / Jenner, who was involved in it, whose name I don't know.
$250,000
$250,000 for posting one message. It worked. But that's the thing. That's the extraordinary thing, is that the power these people have is extraordinary. And she didn't even know what she was supporting, which, of course, is the great injustice and the reason why laws have changed and so forth now, to make sure that advertising is more obvious when people put things up. But these people didn't know why they were there, what they were promoting, knew nothing about it. It was just, here's a paycheck, can you put this thing up on your Instagram? Hashtag Fyre Festival. That'd be great. You know, enjoy your new villa you're going to buy with the money you're going to receive from this. And 95% of tickets sell out in 24 hours. I mean, phenomenal. You know, so props to Billy for kind of understanding how these things work, because, you know, that, you've got to have some chutzpah to kind of realize that you can take advantage of people in that way so successfully.
Fyre, the greatest party that never happened. How important is a title?
That's a really good question. It is important.
It's a great title in comparison to Fyre Fraud, maybe. Like, Fyre Fraud, it makes it very clear. What is this about? Fyre Fraud. But the other one, the greatest party that never happened, sounds intriguing, right?
Yeah, it does sound intriguing. Absolutely. I think that's right. I think, why did I first watch this? I watched it because I was reading a lot of hype about it. And in fact, what drew me to it was the fact that I knew there were these two films out there, so in similar territory, which is also an intriguing concept. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. as soon as I had the chance to watch the other one, which I actually watched on a flight to America, terrible way of making judgment on a film. So if I said anything negative about that film, then forgive me. I was watching it on a small screen. It's probably a work of genius, but I was tainted by
half asleep after a nap. Absolutely. Yeah, just had your microwave meal.
But, exactly. Yeah. But it was interesting to watch and compare the two and see how they handled the same subject in different ways. I think that's the joy of storytelling. You know, I've given you a couple of thoughts on how I might have taken those rushes and, with my approach to storytelling, tried one or two different things. That is by no means to suggest that my version of the film would be better than the one that's out. And I think that's what's exciting about filmmaking, is that if you were to give the same story, the same rushes even, to five different filmmakers, you'll get five different films. And that's a really lovely thing as well. It's down to that creative interpretation of things.
But that's also what's difficult about documentary filmmaking, is that you might be able to take a film like Fyre and take it in five or six different strong directions. So as a storyteller, how do you hone in on the story that you end up with? So do you go for your own personal judgments and think, okay, well, this is a story that personally I want to make? Or is it more, this is the story that should be told?
I mean, it's entirely subjective, Paul. And the whole point is, there is no right and wrong to that. Mm. You know, lots of films are made 10 different times by 10 different people, and hopefully they've got an awareness of what's been out there already and have something fresh to bring to the party. And that's, I think, is important. You know, you want to make sure you're in new territory here and saying something different, or have access to something that hasn't been seen before. But there is no right and wrong. You know, my version of this film, I'm saying this based on having watched this film, so it's unfair, because I'm taking this one and saying, here's what I think might have been a bit stronger for me personally as a viewer. But I probably would have taken a third of the cast members out of it and built up their, some of the individual stories a bit more powerfully, because I'm a firm believer that you gain something by powerful first person testimony. And we had first person testimony here, people who were at the front line of it, who had something more to say about their own involvement, their own story in it. So when you've got 25 cast members, just maths says that you don't have that much screen time for each person to be able to really develop character arcs through the story. If you strip that out, I think what you would end up with is perhaps a slightly less complete telling of the story factually, but a richer telling of the story arguably emotionally. So I'd have tried that, and I would have definitely had a go in the edit at seeing whether Act 1 might have a slightly different texture to it, where we're building a more of a kind of positive to allow the negative to come slightly later in the arc. But that's just a storyteller with a version. If this film had come to me, I wouldn't have said any of those things, because it works and the director's got his vision out there, and that's fine. If someone comes to me with a film that wasn't quite working and was struggling, and they were thinking, what can I do to make this work? Those would be the sorts of thoughts that might have crossed my mind. But just because I would try something different doesn't mean that I enjoyed this film any less.
I want to go back to the linear story arc and way of storytelling. Where is the climax in Fire? Where do you see it?
The climax
isn't the climax always at the end? Isn't it the last, the very last thing?
No, actually, no. I would say it very much isn't at the end. I think most films, I might regret saying most films, I start to analyse that sentence immediately, but a lot of films will have a sort of epilogue to them. So
what's an epilogue?
A bit after the end, where you sort of catch, so the main narrative is over, and now we're just going to do a bit of reflection and throwing forward as to what the future looks like and so forth. So it probably, probably isn't literally the end, but it's close to it. Clearly, you know, if we're talking about the hero's journey, to go back to what this isn't. But if you look at the hero's journey, there'd be that some sort of final battle, if you like, which where our hero triumphs. Mm-hmm. But then they'll return home after that to go and deliver, you know, whatever lessons there are. So that's what we mean here. There's a sort of peak before a sort of mellowing towards the end. The climax for me as a moment is kind of almost literally a man talking about how he was prepared to do all kinds of sexual services for people to get some water released, which, you know, that's for me is actually the biggest moment in the storytelling, where you go, oh my God, that's really how bad it got. And you properly understand the depths of the horror that these people were in here when that becomes where you're at in your head. And I guess, again, just to repeat myself, but the sense of character development and access to first person stories, a bit more of that would have been really great, because really at that moment you understand just how bleak this was, if that's the path that you're treading. But that moment comes even before the festival itself has happened, so it's not obviously the climax of the film. I think what they've done here as a sort of denouement, as the sort of climax, is to take us into the world of our contributors, to have them reflect on the costs to them and their thoughts on the cost that they have inflicted, if you like, on other people. So it's people asking themselves whether, to what extent they were to blame for it, because they were trying to help Billy to solve the problems along the way. It's people talking about the amount of money that they had to pay out to pay for debts that Billy should have covered, but they can't now. They've lost their life savings.
Yeah, there's this emotional part of the woman in the Bahamas.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's that, I think, where we understand what the true costs were to people, where I think the film reached its end. It does then go on for another chapter, the sort of third act, if you like, where we now catch up with Billy's world today being the time the film was made, where he's actually very brazenly started up a business in a similar line of work with a different front man to hide behind, and the cycle goes on, which is kind of where the film actually ends, this kind of idea that maybe this guy is just always going to keep on coming back and pulling the same scam time and time again.
But who bought those tickets in the end?
God,
he's too naive enough, I know.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
People who have a lot of money.
But it's really interesting. I mean, there's a journalist in the piece who says that she uncovered the fact that Billy was back and pulling another scam. He was offering access to tickets that, you know, were meant to be impossible to get. The truth was they are actually impossible to get. You know, the Met Gala tickets were apparently, no member of the public can actually get hold of them. Yeah. Taylor Swift's private appearances, and she never gives private appearances. You know,
it wasn't even a sophisticated scam. It was just he sent emails to the database that he had from the Fyre Festival to try to get people to purchase these tickets.
And just shows, you know, how there's obviously enough people out there who are gullible enough or you know, want to be part of the in crowd.
Anyone who kind of looks at those emails and thinks, oh yeah, I'm going to buy a ticket from that from that email.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I don't know.
Maybe a lot of people. But it ends then on this very dark note because, it's, again, as we said, one of the employees said, we probably see Billy in 10 years doing the same scam again.
Absolutely.
So is this like a very dark note on society, because we'll continue to do or to believe those scams? Or I think they also talk about this Russian, the lifestyle that I think in Russia, there's this company who sells like a private jet and the jet never takes off.
Right, you're just going to get Instagram pictures.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And so this is the type of society we live in.
The last line of the last line of Fyre Fraud, the other film, is something like, there's no better time to be a con man in America than right now. And I think that's, again, obviously a statement on power in America, full stop.
Unfortunately.
But very interesting, again, that, you know, the narrative within society is that actually this may be okay. Yeah. You know, it's,
and you don't have to be subtle anymore. You can do it openly and publicly.
Yeah.
So we talked about beginning, middle, and end, and we definitely talked about the opening and the ending now. But talk about the large part, the second act. Can we deconstruct this a little bit more? Can you do that for us?
Because that second act, it seems to go on from after 20 minutes in, it starts to unravel. And then that lasts until maybe the 85th minute. So a good 65 minutes of middle section.
Well, of story, right? Of story, I mean, that's the way of seeing it. It's story. So the question is, are you engaged by that story? Is it boring? You know, if it's not boring and you're enjoying yourself, then no problem with that.
How did they manage to create such a long middle section there?
The story lends itself to that. But if structurally, if that's what you mean, I think we're building towards this kind of midpoint of the event itself. So you've got a before and after section, if you like, the kind of the build up to it and then the fallout from it. And breaking that down, you know, I think in the build-up to it, you've got a couple of things going on. Firstly, you've got the challenge of the build and the realizing that there's going to be a lot of problems here to overcome, even that's going to be impossible. And that's done sort of drip, drip, drip kind of way, where you just sort of realize that it's a house of cards that is waiting to collapse, you know, where the infrastructure isn't there, where, like I said, the pilot is the guy who's doing the logistics, where the guy who you've got as your right-hand man is kind of totally overwhelmed and wanting to burst into tears because he can't handle multitasking or whatever. We're seeing these things playing out in the archive. You think this is not the steady ship that you want it to be. Mm-hmm. Plus, we're being told about the compressed timeline that's going to throw extra problems into the mix. So that's sort of a sort of chunk of that part of the story. And then there's the, all right, let's try and solve this then, sort of moment where they do, you know, in the face of these kind of horrendous adversities, no one's pulled the plug yet. So now we're heading inexorably towards this deadline, which is going to happen seemingly regardless. And we're going to do all we can to try and save it. And that's where we start to get into some slightly more personal stories where we're hearing people perhaps trying to persuade Billy against it or problem solving along the way to try and get caterers back into the loop at the last minute and so on. So you've got two sort of staging posts, if you like, heading for the launch. Then the launch in itself is obviously a big moment, big turning point, and now we're going to see what the public themselves who come along to this event really make of it. And it's that kind of fallout from that which drives us through the next part of it. And then it's the counting the costs and trying to save face and so on that moves us into the final act. So it's sort of one big act, but it's got a central point of the launch of the event and I think two sort of chunks either side where the narrative is slightly taking us in different directions. But as a whole, it plays as just one continuous timeline, and that is indeed what it is, because they were spotting problems and then trying to solve them, which is what you would try and do. The event happens and you manage the fallout of it, and then you try and, you know, save face or whatever as a result of that. So it's still a linear journey, but texturally you're slightly turning corners along the way that mean that it's got a different tone and rhythm for the audience as you go.
Does it have more acts then, more than three?
I think it's got three acts, but I think you can break that second act into different stages. In terms of the hero's journey, it's interesting, you know, saying that I think you can retrofit a hero's journey onto things sometimes. This one is fundamentally flawed in doing that, because the hero's journey traditionally would always have some sort of positive transformation and revelation and so forth at the end. And as we've said, you know, this is just relentlessly negative. Nothing good happens. No one learns any lessons other than don't work with Billy McFarlane again. You know, it doesn't have that destiny for us. Also, have we actually got a hero? You know, I think we could argue Billy is our hero or anti-hero, as we've said, but he's not in the film really, so that doesn't quite feel right. You know, the hero is someone who we're sort of on a journey with and we're rooting for, and we're rooting against, whatever, but we're with them in some way, and we're just not, because he's not present in the film. So therefore, the entourage, the ensemble, sort of become our hero, which is not really what the kind of archetype of the story arc is meant to be doing, a group of people in different ways feeding into things.
You do feel for Billy at certain points in the film, though.
Do you?
So at points when it just gets so incredibly difficult for him, I mean, he has brought all this onto himself, but there's a point where you put yourself in his position and you question what you would do. Would you see it through to conclusion like he does,
or do you just
cancel the festival and hold? It's such a difficult position. So morally, you know what you should do, but in that position,
I mean, I would say this is now us talking about our personal belief systems. I would say it's a difficult question if you've allowed it to get to the point where you're the day before a festival's going to happen that you've got no chance of pulling off, and do you cancel it or not? But there were many signs along the way that this was a great idea.
There was a point in the film when they were kind of explaining that he was on a quad bike and he was rushing back and forth, just trying to problem solve and just trying to fix what he'd created in some way. And
this was after the event was happening, though.
This was during the event. So, God, there was a point where I was like, oh my God, if I was on that quad bike going back and forth, what? How the hell would I deal with this? And I don't know. So just because of those low moments and moments where you question morally what you might do, do you not start to feel something for Billy, and he does take on more of a hero's role?
I mean, I definitely didn't, but that, you know, again, we're all
it's
individual
more of an
viewers, aren't we?
Anti-hero, yeah. We can definitely.
I think
say
what's
that
great,
better.
What's great about watching films and you know, documentaries and being individuals with our own sort of package of things we bring to the party is we all see things a different way, and I can sit here and say I loved it, and you might say you hated it, and that's fine, or vice versa. And so I definitely wasn't watching that thinking
you've got a cold heart.
Yeah, no, I definitely wasn't watching anything. Poor Billy,
someone who committed such a fraud.
Yeah.
I wasn't.
I mean, if he was doing the quad bike riding a week before the launch date, I might have been more sympathetic for him. But now he's got all these people on the island, and he's going back and forth to figure out how to get out of this mess that he's created single-handedly. Lacking sympathy.
So, Nick, what lessons can we take away from this film? What can our audience learn from it?
It's a very good film. There's lots of things that we could talk about here. But I guess the thing that strikes me is that when you're telling a retrospective story, it's what this film does very well by use of archive is places us in the moment. So through seeing events unfolding on camera as they happened at the time, we're in the present tense with it. And that's a really great tip for people to try and find some way of giving the audience a sense of something unfolding. If you're purely talking in the past tense, jeopardy sort of falls away. Now, what this does very successfully is it uses the first person testimony of the contributors to talk us through events as they unfold. So we're riding it with the people, which is great, but it also plants us in the past and takes us in real time forward through watching Billy and his cohorts wrestling with the things they're wrestling with. So if you're thinking about a retrospective story, and there are many great films out there that do that, think about how you're going to handle that in a way that means we're going to be seeing something that is engaging, that is rich, that is interesting, and is going to hook us as an audience.
Great. So that's Fire. You can see it on Netflix. If you haven't seen it already, see it. If you have seen it, then watch it again after this podcast. You might look at it a bit differently. Thanks a lot for your time, Nick.
Pleasure. I hope it's been interesting.
Thank you. And bye.